Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Yay! And no!
This book is exhilarating in the most emotional way possible.
Oh, this book's perfect! I love this.
It definitely in my top five of characters and definitely character arc.
Misaki is my favorite character in literature.
Misty, or what's the Hobbit song?
It's Misty Mountain.
Is it Misty Mountain?
Faromir, the Misty Mountains cry.
Oh, we were supposed to. Welcome back, everybody, to another Tutor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
And I'm the other host, Richard.
We decided this is a book that Rich and I completely agree on.
Finally, one of these books we actually agree on.
By the title, The Sword of Kaigen is a literal masterpiece.
I absolutely love it. It's in my top 10 books, period.
Yep.
I love this book.
I will go.
And I'm excited to, like, we try not to double dip, you know, like once we do a video on it, that's our video on it. Mm-hmm. We're double dipping. We want to talk about this book more.
And we're going to spoiler free for the first 5 to 10 minutes. Then we're going to spoil it and talk about why it's a masterpiece to us. And I will go even further to say it's not my top 10. It's top 3 for me. Maybe top. Depends on the day. 1, 2, sure, or 3 in my favorite books ever. And yeah, we talked about this, had a whole spoiler-free, spoiler-full version of Sword of Kaigen. You guys can check that out if you want for a more detailed one. We did months and months and months ago. And the longer this book sat with us, the higher it's climbed on the list for me.
Yeah.
Is that the same here for you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The big thing for me, and this is, again, spoiler-free, but I remember after reading it thinking, oh, maybe the ending would have spoiled my thought of the book is entire. Like, how much does the ending for me affect my enjoyment of the whole book? And now, many months, close to a year removed.
Yeah.
Not at all. I still love it. It's such a small footnote of a tiny, tiny critique of, like, there's something about the last chapter is not my biggest, I'm not the biggest fan of. But other than that tiny gripe, the rest of the book is masterfully done.
That's so well put, because even Bookborn, who we've had her on the channel, she talked about how she gives us a 4.5 stars mm-hmm. out of 5. And she did that because that last chapter, we all agree there's something with that last chapter, but the longer, it doesn't matter. This there's 1,000 great things to say about this book. And, like, we all have our gripes with some things. I don't even think it's important to highlight. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's not even worth the conversation part
no,
of it. Because
no,
everything no. else is so masterfully done that little thing doesn't matter.
Yeah, we agree.
Yay!
Yes. This book is by Emma Wang. And just before discussing this as a masterpiece, to convince you to go read this book if you haven't, then to come back and listen to Rich and I have a tickle fight. So this is...
They have video, too. They'll be able to see the tickle fight as well.
At the end, we're promising something this video.
Don't do that. No. Don't make promises that you're going to be forced to keep.
So Emma Wang, she is one of my new favorite authors just based on this book alone. And she submitted this book, or I don't know if you have to submit it yourself. I'm sure she did. But an SPFBO, which is self-published fantasy. Because this is a self-published book. Mm-hmm. Which makes it even more incredible.
Oh, yeah.
A self-published fantasy contest that Mark Lawrence, the author of several books, like Red Sister, go ahead, name some. Book That Wouldn't Burn.
Red Sister, Book That Wouldn't Burn, Prince of Thorns, all those books.
This is his kind of book award thing he puts together.
Mm-hmm. Also, and Bookborn herself is on the panel of judges as well. So she participates in this contest.
And this one won in 2019. Mm-hmm. Beat them all. Of course. It
deservedly so.
Shows that contest has some amazing books that it highlights, mm-hmm. and this was one of them. And this was also, back in the day, one of our patron book clubs of the month, which we discuss books every single month in our Patreon, exclusively on Discord, where you could chat with us. This was the one that we had a deep discussion with people, went mm-hmm. back and forth, and someone like Curtis, for example. Curtis is one of our patrons who said, this book is so great, but it doesn't make sense how it became popular. And I think he has a point.
Yeah.
With it's such a unique book. He goes, oh, how did this become almost just a really widely known book? Mm-hmm. Because it's uniquely structured, like self-published books are.
Yeah, no, this is, I gotta say, I did not see how this story would go. Yeah. I don't think anyone really did. There's a huge twist in it that we're gonna talk about shortly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see it coming. I don't think I've read anything else kind of like that.
I'm so happy you love this.
Yeah.
I love to gush about things.
Oh, yeah. This is gushing session. Just we're here talk about good things.
Gushing with the boys.
Positive gushing session. A lot of tongue. I bit my lip today.
You did.
And I'm getting caught over my
did
tongue.
Did you or
twisters.
Did I bite?
Don't give them. Don't give them fuel. You just don't add fuel
to
the fire.
You make it too easy. After the ACOTAR review, it's, you know, the tension.
Oh, no, I get it. No, we set the mood. We had the candle. I get it.
By the way, for everybody out there, we are doing book two as well. Just
Yeah, we are. The video did way too well for us to not do book two.
Come on. We're view whores. Why wouldn't we? Right?
Of course. We give the people what they want, and the people apparently want more.
Democracy is cringe, but it pays. Also, I generally had a good time with that review. We actually had fun. That was awesome.
If you're always interested, like, what do we do videos about?
Yeah.
It's the constant game of first, what do we want to do?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things I want to do.
Yeah.
And then we choose of those things, what do people actually want to watch?
That's exactly how our process goes.
Basically that. And so I did enjoy doing the ACOTAR video, especially not making it a traditional review.
Yeah.
I had way more fun. And so had more fun. Thankfully, it did well. So
Best of both worlds. And it's weird that we're mentioning this masterpiece Sword of Kaigen next to ACOTAR in this video. It's just a little poetic, you know?
Yeah.
I want to say to give those people who haven't read this, and then we'll get into why it's a masterpiece. Rich, you will probably agree, clarify this. But mm-hmm. the Sword of Kaigen has the best characters I've read in best characters. Don't even consider this a read. Best characters in all of fiction, in all of film, in all of television, in all of books that I've personally come across. Yes, you're going to get different characters, but as far as it can't get better for what this book was going for your main characters, your side characters, your tertiary characters, it is essentially flawless. And that's why the longer this book has sat with me, the more I just like sit up at night, I get emotional thinking about this book still, because I feel these characters are real. Not just, everyone has an arc, everyone represents a theme in this book, and the themes of this go over things such as grief, loss, regret, abuse, rebuilding, purpose, love, tradition, rebellion, and all of that is packed into a punch with all these characters in this amazing world with an incredibly unique plot. And I think Emma Wang just somehow popped out this masterpiece of a book, and I will forever be following her career. And I am forever a fan.
I'm surprised you haven't read Blood Over Brighthaven yet.
I will be. Yeah. This did everything to me. It hits all those notes, and I could not have asked for more. Sword of Kaigen is essentially flawless.
I mean, I'm kind of with you on I don't know if I go. I'm always hesitant to give like those absolutes.
I'm a bit of a superlative guy. You know, I get excited. I get you. Do give your Richard mood.
I'm hesitant to give those. Uh-huh. It's kind of the same thing of I'm careful with some of the words I like to use. And people would call me that, you're being very cold. It's like, no, it's because I value those words.
Others see as cold, you see as calculated.
That's a calculated choice of words for you to make me look bad. But no, the main thing is the characters here are definitely some of the best arcs and more unique angles that I've seen in fiction. The fact that I've seen these type of characters gone in a more standard path and a more standard direction. Like the idea of expectations, of tradition and how that affects your life going forward. Do you stick to tradition? Do you
rebel?
Yeah. Everyone's seen that kind of story. I don't think many people have seen it done this way. That's the reason why it's special.
Yeah.
I'm a little tired of talking spoiler free though. I don't know about you. We already did a review on it. Go watch that review. Go read this book, then come back. But we're getting into spoilers because I can't contain it anymore.
Let's go. First thing, let's break this down why it's a masterpiece and go character by character.
Okay.
Starting with obviously Misaki.
Yeah. What a absolutely wonderful character. It definitely in my top five of characters and definitely character arcs that I got to read the book again, in all honesty.
I think she's my favorite character ever. It's her, Dalinar's up there, peak Darrow sometimes.
But sometimes.
Depends on the book.
Darrow's not always in the top five. No. Depends on the book, depends on the day.
Misaki is my favorite character in literature. I will say that.
Damn.
Yeah.
And I can't fault you for it. The idea that you take a character that I could really easily see this character going a more traditional route of a story of oppression by parents' expectations and oppressed by tradition, and easily make this story just a story of, you know, forget the past, let it die, kill it if you must. Just more like, hey, tradition sucks and stupid fuddy-duddy old people, don't listen to them, do what your heart desires. And that's all that matters.
Basically, a lot of coming of age.
The thing is, that's just stories. A very ignorant position on tradition and history and family expectations. That's really ignorant to say. It's the message of, like, unwise youth of just rebel for rebellion's sake. The more wise approach, which I think this book gets into quite a bit, is... It's a kind of political ideology of when you walk across a field and you see a fence and you look around, you don't know why it's there. Now, the fact that you don't know why the fence is there, do you tear it down because you don't see a reason for it? Or do you leave it up because it was built there for some reason? Let me find out why it was built in the first place and be cautious. And that's kind of the idea of tradition. Anyway, this book goes into that really well. I love Misaki. She clearly has regret. She has resentment toward her family traditions and the path that she went down.
Yeah.
And she's haunted by that. And I absolutely love it. It's not really even a resentment toward her parents. It's resentment at herself. And her thinking that something is wrong with her for not wanting what her parents wanted for her.
Yeah. And you're talking very, Lord. Very spot on about the best kind of messages in books don't just fully take on one thing, unless it's something obvious, like, yes, love is good and these kind of things. But when you have something so complex, you're talking about tradition versus rebellion, and it's saying something about both. It's not just saying, hey, go rebel, do whatever. It's not saying follow tradition, because both are wrong and both are right.
Yeah, no, there's...
Go ahead. Yeah.
It's important to realize that... I think this is an obvious thing, but not everyone's going to agree. But tradition exists for a reason. Before you change it, you must realize why it was put there in the first place. It's fine for traditions to change. It always has, always will. But we, as the next generation, owe it to all previous generations to at least try and understand why, because that will help us going forward.
Hey, that can actually help you fix it more if you know why it's there in the first place, right?
So before you change a tradition, before you change what was done before, you should understand. And the wonderful thing about Masaki is by the end of the book, she does. That's the wonderful thing.
She understands, and then
she is frustrated because she followed the traditional path that was laid before her without understanding why. And because of that, she does have some regrets, and her life is a hard one. But by the end, she realizes the lesson too late, but she ultimately is happy with the path laid before her. And it kind of shows one of the benefits of, broadly speaking, of what tradition brings to you is, even if you don't understand it, the path is laid before you. And for many people, that path works. For Masaki, it kind of works in the end, and she can understand it, and she feels relief that she finally understands the happiness that her parents always wanted for her in having a family and being a mother.
And that's the whole start of her character, is she has to decide whether to follow the expectations of her parents and the tradition of her parents to go marry this person she doesn't want to marry, mm-hmm. or go the rebellious route of marrying for actual love in her heart and follow what she'd want to do with Robin. So she's given this love triangle story of, do I go for Takaru and follow what my parents have said, or do I go for Robin? And it's the story of, it's the person who actually went with tradition. And then the consequences of that throughout the story showing, hey, she followed it because her parents said this would be the right life and she would love her children. But guess what? She has these children and doesn't even love her kids. She looks at them her whole life and goes, I did this for what? I could have followed love, but now she has all this regret because she followed the traditional route and is living in this constant regret. She does not love her kids. The one benefit of what she was supposed to feel from choosing that route.
I think there's something that the magic system adds to this, but I think is more, speaking of something that people actually can go through, is in this book, the magic system talks about with the connection to the elements and all, because Takaru is, you know, controls water, but basically has almost a heart of ice, and that is really cold to the touch, freezing. And with Robin, with the connection with fire, it was always very warm. And so when she feels and hugs her children, she just feels cold. And she is reminded of Takaru, someone she resents, hates, just all these negative emotions, feelings. So how I kind of took this is the mother who can't help but see their father in her children, and a father who they resent.
Can I give you a quote there? It exactly explains it. So in the book, it says, for 15 years, Masaki had lamented being fated to raise her husband's sons. All that time, she hadn't considered that these boys might have something of her in them too. Exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Of, she only saw the person she hated, which was this husband she is spiteful against, rightfully so, because she emotionally, and I can't remember if it was physically as well, but abuses her regardless, mm-hmm. and is horrific to her. And so she passes that on to the kids, who are obviously innocent in this, but she can't help it because Takaru's awful. And so she hates her kids via her husband being awful. And then she finally comes to this realization of, wait, these are my kids too. And the tragedy of it, if she figures this out too late, she finally connects with Mamoru, and then Mamoru dies. And so it's, and then her whole message after that of her finally, this is character arc happened. She figured it out. And then you're like, oh yeah, her and Mamoru are going to go live happily ever after. No.
You think like
some memo, like you dirty dog.
It's you think so powerful. You think they're gonna run away together and go like, yes,
yes,
Mamaru
beat up Takaru.
Woo!
Yeah,
take the kids and run.
Yay!
And
no. This book is exhilarating in the most emotional way possible. Mm-hmm. Because then after that happens, after Mamaru dies, what the lesson she learns in the latter half is not. That's why the exact thing you're talking about against choosing Robin versus choosing Takaru. Her whole life has happened. She still has other children. She chose Takaru, even though she regrets it and maybe made the very wrong decision. Regardless, it's the choice she made, and she's going to understand it, and she's going to make the best out of it. And she, then you have those whole scenes with Takaru, but she adjusts and goes, I will not make the same mistake I made with Mamaru. I have these children left. I am going to not repeat that, and I will make a life out of this. Mm-hmm. I will grow. And that's where the change in rebellion comes.
And ultimately, by the end, I think she makes she does let the regret go. Of ultimately, like, yes, maybe she, like, probably would have been happier with Robin going down that path. But she ultimately, like, she's not sure. Like, it's possible that everything could have gone wrong with Robin as well. But what she does know is that she has her children. And she loves them. And that is worth it. Her children were worth all of the pain. And ultimately, that takes, her children basically take away that regret. Because the regret would mean to regret her children.
Yeah, you said this perfectly. The whole message, well, there's a million messages in here. Yeah. But one of the messages that just rings so true is you really only feel regret if you are deeply unhappy with your current state of life. Because if you are currently happy, it's almost a catch-22 where if life is great, life is good, you don't have much to complain about. If you were to regret anything, that means anything you changed in your past would have led you to a different place. Mm-hmm. Feeling depressed, feeling ultra sadness, feeling that regret comes from, I am not okay right now. I would rather be elsewhere. But she finally accepts that, hey, I'd rather be nowhere else than with my own children. Therefore, mm-hmm. the regret can go. Because if I made that other choice, I wouldn't have these beautiful children.
Yeah.
God, I love this book, and that's just Misaki.
God,
that's just Misaki. That's a whole story right there.
We haven't even kind of gone on to the very interesting character journey. It's much shorter because it's by the end.
Yeah,
cool. But her learning how to connect with her husband. Her,
yeah. Dude, do you want to talk about Takaru?
Let's lead right to Takaru.
Okay.
Connecting with Misaki. Misaki has great reason to hate Takaru.
Plenty.
I hated Takaru. I was going through like, my God, this is the worst character ever. I want him to like just.
Can I tell a quick story about how you read into that?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Because Takaru to me was the most irredeemable piece of shit.
Yeah.
And I was reading this book glued to the pages, and I finished it quickly. A rare thing for Austin. And so you were halfway through the book or so, and you came just complaining to me of just, Takaru is just kill him. He's dead. I hate him. There's nothing he can do. He just wasn't at the scene happened where he refused to bury his son and tossed him wherever the Kaganese Empire.
Yeah.
I think that was the scene you just watched. There's nothing. There's no explanation for this. He's the villain. All this, right?
Yeah. No, and I was literally the chapter
before.
Yeah. And I was like, kill him.
Yeah.
I want him gone. And to the point of disliking the book to a certain degree of going,
it makes no sense. He's so evil.
This doesn't make any sense. I don't understand it. This character was made wrong.
I had the same thoughts. And then we were proved wrong. that moment of, does it justify his actions? No.
Let's explain the moment.
Explain the moment from your perspective.
So that after that conversation with Austin, going all of the moments where Takaru has basically forced himself on Misaki, where he has emotionally abused her and neglected her for years, when ultimately how he treats his own son, and that when it push comes to shove, when his son is dead, he doesn't even stand up and have the backbone to bury his son or be with his family for that. And it was like, absolutely not. His character's dead to me.
It doesn't even make sense to a degree.
Yeah.
It's so, I just don't get it.
Yeah. Then The next chapter, we get the duel. And we finally get to hear Takaru's side of things, which doesn't redeem him completely. It
does not justify
it. Honestly, especially. It doesn't redeem. It doesn't justify.
Explains.
It explains. And that's all it does. He was still wrong. He still not, his actions were wrong. But now you understand him and you see that he is also suffering in his own way too.
And it puts that perspective from the reader of course we're judging him, but just going how in the world, maybe redeemable versus irredeemable is the wrong words mm-hmm. to say, but just there's no explanation for this. And then to be shown and confronted that the reasons for this is he saw his parents, first his father abused him and his mother, that her mother died during childbirth or there was too powerful. How'd the magic work? Remember that? Where if you're too powerful of a...
The magic can kill... So basically the flow of magic can kill the... can kill the mother especially.
Yeah.
Basically the reason why Takaru and Misaki marry is because... Or Takaru married Misaki is because Misaki was very powerful
mm-hmm.
with her magic.
Children,
basically could handle Takaru's children.
Yep.
Because if it was a... non-magical mother, basically Takaru's children have too much magic and would kill the mother.
Yeah,
that's kind of the magic explanation of yep. why they got together. That happened to Takaru's mother.
Yes.
And his life is definitely one of suffering, high expectations, and ultimately he ran away and through the magic system found a way to cope with his suffering, his anxiety, his mistreatment.
The magic system is basically an analogy for how humans feel when they just close up.
Basically disassociating.
Yeah.
He disassociated from his emotions and from his circumstances and basically coming like a robot, just going through the motions.
One with the mountain. He's not even here presently. Yes, he's talking with his mouth, but he spreads with the magic system his entire self to the areas around him to disassociate with the actual problem at hand. So he avoids confronting exactly what you're saying. He's disassociating and all those decisions that he's made now make sense.
Yeah.
He's not even being human right now.
And when his son died, he was so distraught. I think it was like weeks that he just... Basically, his mind was out of his body for weeks because he couldn't handle going back to his body.
Exactly.
Because if he did, the grief would all come.
I should clarify, he always
avoids anything difficult, anything emotional, any kind of grief, he avoids.
Yep.
And
it's worked for him because he didn't have to deal with the things he dealt with as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, I mean, it's really not working in a practical matter. But I do want to correct, no, this isn't, it's not that he's no longer human. He is human and he's disassociating purposely. So he's making that decision. So he's not a literal robot.
Yeah.
But he's using the tools he has to make the wrong choice.
To explain a really good system of the magic system here of it's basically Avatar, The Last Airbender magic system. Mm-hmm. It's water bending, fire bending, a bunch of different element bending abilities. But the thing that they are able to do is within their element, they are able to basically extend their consciousness, kind of like imagining that their fingers now reach even further through their element, that they can perceive, they can sense the element around them. And the more powerful you are, the further range, the deeper you're able to feel into it.
Mm-hmm.
So with Misaki, able to control water, is able to feel deeper into blood, basically is able to sense the blood and go into it deeper that other waterbenders wouldn't be able to. Takaru is so powerful with it that he's able to expand his consciousness and connection with water the size of a mountain. He's able to feel all of the water for miles around. But because it spreads his consciousness over such a wide area, it makes his body feel so large that now the problems of his small body don't feel so big.
Therefore, the grief doesn't hurt.
And yeah, it's, which, interesting way to frame it. Of, yeah. In all honesty, it's kind of something I would think about sometimes, of if something really hard to think about. Don't know if you ever see this, Brendan Gray, you know, friend from high school.
Hey.
Whenever we were anxious going into a mock trial thing, he's like, he'd have start the mantra of like, hey, just imagine that, you know, about to walk in there, but keep, imagine that we're just a couple specks on this planet, spinning around, flying out, hurtling through space, just a bunch of
on the back of a giant turtle.
On the back of a giant turtle. Yep. Just kind of see like how small, like see how big the universe is to notice how small our current problem is, and that we shouldn't feel so anxious about it. And it's something that I also think about sometimes. Well, I'm sure most, many other people do as well.
So you and the lesson of Takaru is to disassociate.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, basically. So there is the point when you're handling something that you shouldn't be nervous for, or it could be a useful tool when, okay, going in front of a stage or something that you're fearful for and giving you the confidence by using that as a tool.
Basically, giving yourself perspective can be a very good thing.
Maybe it's something with this, of you're using that tool to confront. You're using that tool to confront where Takaru is using it to avoid, because you're looking at something of doing good at presenting at a mock trial or giving a speech or singing in front of a crowd, and you use that tool to be confident and to make it purposeful, whereas your avoidance and the negative emotions that you don't want to feel like Takaru, using that as a tool is more negative. Is that a difference between the two?
I guess so. I mean, I always think of it of, like, if you're ever asked, like, if you ever have a question, like, how you get over stage fright, my personal opinion on it is you have to, like, embarrass yourself pretty badly. Like, think of the worst time that you've embarrassed yourself on stage or publicly.
What's the worst? You know, I'll ask that after. Finish your thought.
Sure.
Yeah.
And when you remember that, you realize, like, you know what? I got through that. Whatever I'm about to do is probably not going to be that bad.
Yeah.
And it all of a sudden kind of goes away.
If, like, yeah, yeah.
Like, I imagine to answer your question of, like, level of embarrassment. Like, I was auditioning for something in front of a panel for a jazz state festival.
Yeah.
A state competition, whatever it was. And I was just unprepared completely. Severely outclassed. I was not, like, I walked in there realizing, like, absolutely, like, I have zero chance. And when I played, like, the nerves broke up. Like, I did not deserve to be there. And it was incredibly embarrassing. So embarrassing. But after that, I never had a problem after that incident, because anytime I'd get, like, a little slightly nervous, I just, like, you know, it's never going to be as bad as that.
So
never going to be that bad.
All
so
of our unearned confidence on this pod comes from us embarrassing ourselves in the merch video, being publicly in a gym in those booty shorts. So now there's nothing on this table that is lower creme than that.
Basically, yeah.
So we kind of come off a little bit more like, you know, it's fine. It's going to be okay.
It's basically like, you're afraid of the water and how cold it is. You just got to jump.
Yeah.
And once you're wet, it's all fine.
Leap
of faith. You take the plunge. It's almost never as bad as you anticipate it to be.
But Takaru would take this disassociating and made you it basically into a
take,
sense.
You take that perspective and then take it too far of, oh, this doesn't matter. I'm just not going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even going to face the problem.
Yeah. Avoiding completely.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's not justifying Takaru. It's explaining him and making him such more of a real character. And also makes you think about your biases and perspective of people. Because as soon as you flip an irredeemable character you don't understand, and you give them their perspective, what that does to a reader like me, like you, people reading this, it just goes, wow, I was quick to judgment. And yes, his actions are wrong.
Yeah,
it's but that judgment of flipping a perspective.
Why?
Yeah,
of why was he so cold to Misaki? Mm-hmm. And realized, like, in his mind, he's still wrong to do this, but he saw how uncomfortable she was with him and how much she hated him. And so in his mind, he didn't want to be his father and physically abuse her. He, like, of course not. He never wanted to do that.
Yeah.
But also he knew that his just very presence made her incredibly uncomfortable. And so he stayed away. He tried to only interact with her for as little amount as humanly possible, thinking that that was the kindness of that. Oh, I disgust her, so I'm going to stay away.
From his perspective, he's being completely good.
Yeah. And so, like, hey, which, stupid, talk to the woman, you damn man. Like, come on.
Yeah.
But
that's why he was so frustrating to read and how you just couldn't understand him that whole time. We are getting Misaki's point of view as well of how this makes no sense. Why is he acting like this? He's an awful father. I can't even love my children because I made this regretful decision to marry this monster of a man. Mm-hmm. And readers thinking this too. And then the Mama Wang just flips it and gives us that nugget of, okay, this is why he does that. And then you sit there and go, wow, okay. So even if we're judging somebody, it's that perspective of even if they're the worst person, like Takaru, there was something there that I didn't know. And even understanding why he made the wrong decisions is just as helpful as is not understanding why someone makes right decisions. Because if you're a good character as well, we can kind of take that for granted. We can kind of take for granted good actions and mm-hmm. not need an explanation. Of course you're going to be kind to puppies. Of course you're going to do this. But when someone's evil, we almost need an explanation. We almost need there can't just be a psychopath out there. And those can be written. Of course, there's people that are just messed
thing
up.
Thing is, and for those people, you want it to at least be fun. Like, the true evil, like, just evil for evil's sake. The reason why those characters work is normally
Jack Horner from Puss in Boots 2.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just fun that they have some type of
presence.
Gravitas.
Oh, what's the boys? Homelander?
Yeah.
Hannibal Lecter.
Name a bunch.
Anton from No Country for Old Men. These just psychopaths that are there for the pure purpose of striking fear.
Yeah.
And
it
that's
works.
What they're there for. That's it works, of course.
But if you don't have that gravitas, you don't have that presence, and they're pure evil, it's like, it just doesn't work.
You just need to understand, right?
So with Takaru, he doesn't have that presence of evil, but you don't understand him. So that's why I was so frustrated with him until, of course, the duel chapter.
Yeah.
But then I think something is important to stay on more his flaws rather than just his perspective.
Yeah,
of him and Misaki in many ways are very similar, of they both follow tradition without truly knowing why. Like, Takaru also doesn't completely understand all of the different traditions and rules, and when he's actually confronted with the truth, he just outright denies it and just, like, nope, doesn't go along with the approved thought.
No, Kaigani's empire is not lying to us. Nope, it's real.
And he knows. He's smart enough to know that he's being lied to, and yet...
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
He always takes the easy and already made path.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what Misaki did as well. So both similar in that way. How he thinks of women is also just wrong. And he learns the lesson as well in that chapter, especially where he treated her with kid gloves like porcelain. Because that's how he won. I mean, part of this is that's how his mother died. His mother was fragile to the magic. And saw that basically, literally, him and his siblings killed his own mother because of how powerful they are and how weak she turned out to be, physically, not emotionally. Don't, you know. But kind of makes sense why he sees women that way. And so he treats Misaki as porcelain, mainly of like, he doesn't respect her enough to actually talk to her and give her the honest truth because he thinks that she wouldn't be able to handle it. He thinks that she is so fragile, so he stays away. He tries to just give her ultimate comfort without any type of difficulty or any type of conflict.
And in his mind, he's doing
as out of kindness of how he sees it.
Yeah.
And when finally, and all this time, he doesn't understand Misaki. Misaki doesn't understand him. They haven't talked. They haven't talked at all, apparently, in all of their years of being married to each other. And finally, when they do, he respects her as a warrior, of like, because she beat him. She kicked his ass. Cool, by the way. That was awesome fight scene. Just
peak. Hey! I want to make a good note on that too, just a clarifying note that he doesn't fix that all in the book. Like, he's fixing that. It leaves off in the point where
him
and Misaki, it leaves off with us being able to know that it's not complete.
No.
It's far from it, but far from where they began. And that's that confident thing that it leaves that bittersweet taste in your mouth. Well, that they lost so much, but
they're
also
talking.
Yeah, their future has so much potential because they're communicating now. They understand each other understand each other now. And I won't do it. Never mind. I won't do it. I was going to say, like, yeah, the whole miscommunication trope, like, the best that I've ever done. Sword of Kaigen and Wheel of Time, you know, basically the same.
Oh, no. Wheel of Time takes that and... Yeah. Runs.
They runs with it.
It runs with it. And hey, look, if it's not for you, if like the whole miscommunication and, you know, just men and women just not understanding each other, if that's not for you, like oh yeah, it'll frustrate you.
Yeah, yeah.
You just kind of have, like, if you're going to the wheel time, you just kind of have to accept that.
Kind of like in a way you were frustrated with Takaru. You didn't understand him.
Yeah.
Communication wasn't there.
With wheel time, like, I understand that, like, one, I get that's this the theme of the book, of
yeah.
And I enjoy it because I see both of their perspectives, and I know they're both being idiots.
Yeah.
And so it's fun to see it that way. Because I can imagine with Wheel of Time, if I only saw the man's perspective, I'd be very frustrated with the women characters.
Because, if you only saw the woman characters, you would be very frustrated with the man's.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where, because I get to see both, I see them all as, like, it's fun to see them how flawed they are.
Yeah.
And then the occasional times where, like, there's a little hope, like, oh my God, they're actually communicating. Oh, thank God, they're actually talking.
And Rich, that was enjoyable. Only Misaki and Takaru.
Oh, we got more characters to go through.
We didn't even touch on who could be the main character, Mamoru, at least at first.
Oh God, and the fact that
this is
person on front cover of book. Yeah. I think.
Wait, let me.
Yeah, see. No, that's Mamoru.
That's Misaki. Oh wait, that's Mamoru.
It could be either.
I can't tell actually.
Which is, I guess, way, the point you're not supposed to, but
the two different main characters here are Misaki and Mamoru. Those are the point of views that we get.
I imagine that this
is that the Whispering Blade?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. I mean, I'm looking at it now, it really could be. My thought is that this is the final scene for Mamoru of he has conquered the Whispering Blade. He looks out and dies, or anyway. But yeah. Have you ever read a story like that where the main character dies halfway through and we get basically new main character?
Well, I mean, here's the thing, in more of epic fantasy, so Game of Thrones doesn't happen half, but Game of Thrones-esque type of death, but not in this way where you have multi-pav epics. This is a book with two point of views.
Well, this is one main point of view. And
then Misaki's there.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of Misaki. Like, it's an interesting perspective where it sets it up so well to think
it's Mamoru's story.
Mamoru's story. We get a bit of Misaki because we get the tragedy on. They kept setting up the rest of the empire, all this where I'm going. Like,
did you feel it was going to be a hero's journey?
100%.
Did you feel it was going to be, oh, I've read this before. Okay, I'm here for another. Cool. We'll take over the Kaiganese Empire. Yeah.
I'm going to bet you thought the same thing of it was basically there's going to be this big fight. And then Mamoru, Misaki, we're going to escape with the rest of the children and have to avoid Takaru. Maybe Mamoru would actually have to fight Takaru and
Takaru's run away from the final boss after they fought in the... Yeah.
But, like, they were all going to run away together to escape to the rest of the Empire and going to have to make it on their own in the big city. And then that's where Misaki's POV was really helpful in seeing the different, seeing the city and how it is and how... why they go to the city and how she'll be able to get around. Maybe she'll meet Robin. That is the story that easily could have been told. I love that they didn't.
You know how there's just this multiverse of stories you could create? You have this fabric of an idea. And Emma Wang had this fabric of an idea. There are an infinite number of possibilities that a book could go down. Mm-hmm. And I know she picked the best one. All the million... of the infinite amount of choices she could make... she picked the best one.
Yeah.
She's a genius. And Mamoru, that's such an easy direction to go. We've read that before. And she seeds this in so perfectly where Mamoru, just like we find out Takaru is later in the book, but Mamoru is seeking the approval of his father. He both is rebellious in a sense. He's a teenager and goes, they're lying to us. They're lying to us. They're making us be their cannon fodder. Mm-hmm. And he's finding out, I don't know when he finds that out or what the order is of it, but Mamoru wants to also get his father's approval because he has these deep expectations that are put on him. And the fascinating thing with Mamoru's character is it, again, just like all these stories can go one easy direction of Takaru could easily be just this plain villain unexplained, or Misaki could choose just tradition or choose just rebellion. Mamoru doesn't get rid of that seeking his approval from his father. That's still there. And the tragedy of him is he accomplishes the goal of doing the thing his father always wanted him to. His father never saw it, but he still in the end felt a sense, there was that bittersweetness of, no, he didn't get his father's approval, and that's something he always strived for, but he also did it.
Well, a part of it is, I thought was really wise of ML Wang to put here is it started with Mamoru and also with Misaki of there are the expectations others put on us and also the ones that we put on ourselves. And I think Mamoru definitely had, he didn't just want the approval of his father. That's too simple of it. Mm. He had high expectations for himself. He wanted to be powerful. He wanted to be strong like his father. For his father's approval, partly. But a lot of it was for himself. It was the same thing with Misaki.
Maybe why I felt so bittersweet is that he did it and he completed his own mission.
Oh, yeah.
And do you feel good for him?
He does not get up every morning and train as hard as he does just for his father's sake. He wanted it. It wasn't, woe is Mamoru for, just doing what his doing all these things for his father's approval. It's part of it. Maybe that's where it started. But it isn't why he continued. And it's the same thing with Misaki kind of realized along the way of she did what she did. She married Takaru because of the expectations of her parents, but also she wanted to. She wanted it. She wanted the life that they talked about. She wanted to make her parents happy. She wanted those traditions.
You're talking about something important where there's a seed of, yes, you do something because someone else does want this for you. Mamoru did want this in a sense because, hey, wants to make his father happy, but there's also that seed of, hey, I also have my own motivations too. I also have mm-hmm. my desires as well. It's not so black and white.
Yeah. And that's why his end is still pretty happy in this, not happy, but it's the bittersweet because he does actually accomplish something he's been wanting to do himself.
Yeah.
So ultimately he did succeed.
And the line at the end is, a decade later, a 15-year-old Hiroshi would become known as the youngest swordsman ever to master the Whispering Blade. What the world would never know was that he was the second youngest.
Oh.
Rich, how many times did this book make you cry or close to crying?
Close to crying is there. How many times in total? I think like three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got the moment with Maru's death. You have her and not loving her children. And that scene she has with Mamoru and realizing how wrong she was.
Come on now. I was misty-eyed there. Yeah. Not misty-eyed. I had some tears to shed.
Just had to clarify.
Yeah,
you do cry. Yeah.
I cry. It was, God, that was...
Yeah, I think my total was also rough. Three cries. And yeah. I think the third one came in the end... I don't know. The duels are more exciting. You know, it's two for sure. I can't remember a third, but I remember there being when we get to the other characters, there were some, yes, we'll talk about that in the next characters here. Some of her friends.
Yeah.
Some of Misaki's friends. And oh my God, the secondary characters have some. Do you want to move on from Mamoru? And
I feel like we're missing some stuff. Like there's more to talk about with him, but.
But we talked about. It feels wrong because we talked about Misaki and Takaru for so long and Mamoru for so little.
But
that is the crux
ultimately, of he's a really enjoyable character. And if we're not talking about him longer, it's because his time was unfairly cut short. And that he could have, it's the same tragedy when you get into, I don't want to say, if I said that, that's spoilers for that other series.
Then so don't do
I
that.
Will
yeah,
not
yeah.
do that. But
good hold.
We're thinking the same book.
Send it to me.
Remember like where it's like, gone before their time. And it was rough.
I'm not following yet.
Your favorite series.
Oh, then yeah. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, you know.
Okay. Well, that gave it away. Wait, do people know whether Red Rising or Stormlight's my favorite series? That's the question. Because, I shouldn't have said that out loud. But I know exactly which book and who you're talking about, and I think you were vague enough.
I did my best.
Yeah. By the way, I won't say what my...
No.
That's it. Quiet. Keep it vague.
Keep it vague.
Keep it vague.
You know what I'm talking about.
Now I know exactly what you're talking about. That is exactly it.
Yep.
Those are my favorite character arc. I love redemption stories and failed redemption stories. Redemption stories and... Yes, redemption stories and the redemption that's cut off too quick. Or where they're just on the up and coming
the
and
failed
you see
potential.
The hope and the failed... Yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. The failed potential. So, so, so good.
Let's move on to some of the side characters here.
to mention zombies, we can't even cover them all.
Yeah.
I want, since we're talking about Mamoru, a quick aside with how masterful Emma Wang is, even with children characters and side characters of Hiyori is, sorry, not Hiyori, Hiroshi, the five-year-old younger brother of Mamoru. Not in many scenes at all. No. It's him, Nagasa, there's a third kid as well. There's these little kids, and they all have these little personalities too to them. Just something so impactful to me. This might have been, this was another one of the misty-eyed moments. So I think I got two tears, two cries, two misty eyes, and like a third bawling. I think that those were my range of cries. And our new Rambler rating system is top tier is cried out, completely bawled your eyes out, misty-eyed, and then we sing Misty, or what's the Hobbit song?
It's Misty Mountain.
Is it Misty Mountain?
Faromir, the Misty Mountains cry.
Oh, we're supposed to. Yeah.
Didn't prep that line.
So Hiroshi is this five-year-old kid, and the way that the kid handles grief, we're experiencing grief from Misaki's point of view, and we're seeing how she reacts to her son's death, that she just finally figured out she didn't love him her whole life, and it was too late. And then we're seeing Takaru, who completely avoids the grief. And then we see Hiroshi, the kid's perspective, how a kid handles grief, where he said something along the lines of, when he finds out his brother died, he says, well, then how can I ever best him, and how can I ever be better than him if he's dead, Mom? Coming from an adult, that would be horrific, right? It's
he's trying to process it of realizing that his brother will never be, like, his brother will always be ahead of him. Now that he's always tried to catch up to his brother, and being 5 years old.
That showed a lot of how much he respected his brother. He's like, my brother's so good, I want to be better than him because I look up to him. Yeah. So it was him saying, I look up to my brother so much, how can I ever have him be proud of me and get better than him? That's the undertone of it. And you're just going, this book's perfect. I love this.
All the kids, normally writing children, I think, is really difficult. They normally can come across as very, either really annoying or overly cute to the point of like
unbelievability.
Yeah. I think all the kids here were sufficiently weird.
Put that on the license plate. Rich thinks kids are sufficiently weird.
But with the magic system, these kids are a bunch of little monsters, is what they are. They're a little messed up.
I think they're appropriately cute and appropriately scary.
They are all scary. And Misaki realizing, like, my husband's kids, they're kind of monsters. With, you know, us being the entry, I was like, Misaki, you're also kind of a monster. You're also very, very scary. It took two.
If we're defining monsters as just power level, everybody in the book is scary.
Power and also level of being able to disregard human life pretty easily. Like, willingness to kill pretty easily. And just freaky mentality of that sense. Takaru and Misaki are both monsters. And so are their kids. Kids are
They've
terrible.
Created some powerful demons.
They're terrible little demons.
But it's such a small note that means so much to the story of even getting to process that kid's grief and his little brother's grief. And we get these other moments that highlight other messages surrounding the book. Again, going to the 20 themes of this, we have grief, loss, regret, abuse, rebuilding, purpose, love, tradition, rebellion. And I missed a lot.
Yeah.
I missed a lot. And the other character, I'll say this small character that you'll agree that there's not much to discuss other than it being a good note, is Takashi, the brother of Takaru, and how his purpose was fight. He wanted to die in battle. He kind of felt useless his whole life being this politician. He was just looking for a bit of purpose and got to live that. Not much else to say other than that was what was said, unless you have something to add onto it.
That his wife.
Yeah, we're getting into his wife in that, yeah.
But it was poignant.
Yeah.
It was a little special that she understood him so well that she, of course, she grieved for her husband, but there was a part of her that was happy for him. She knew that ultimately that's what he want. That's what he wanted.
The amazing thing. Can I transition into that for you?
Comparing that with Misaki and Takaro, especially of like that's how well she knew her husband, that even in his death, had a little bit of happiness for him and glad that he was able to have, basically, he wasn't able to have the life he wanted, but he was able to have the death he wanted.
That's amazing. And just to transition that for you, then go off with this, of the reason I'm bringing up Takashi first and also Dai Yukino, the other, the trainer, these fighters, was them and Takaru were all the trio that kicked ass. And the fighters that were out on the battlefield is part of the story, but then the more important part was the aftermath. This whole book's about the aftermath after that climax happens, where we get the perspective of Sasuke, the wife of Takashi, and then Hiyori, the wife of Yukino Dai, I believe is his name. And the important part you're going into with Sasuke is, yes, he perfectly said, Rich, where he fulfilled his purpose in death, if not life. Beautiful. Yeah. But then we get this dichotomy between Hiyori and Sasuke of what happens to them and how they handle grief after the death of their husbands, where Sasuke, and big clarification here too. So first they're dealing with the grief, but then after that, Hiyori also gets raped. So there's another layer to talk about.
And not just raped.
Yeah.
But also now has
a child
became pregnant from her rapist.
Yes.
And in this kind of, especially, like, obviously, all the things you're thinking, like, terrible for any situation. But in this setting of how a very traditional household, very conservative aspect of it, that she looks, it's tragic how she feels about the child as well, and that the child is, she sees it not as that she was violated, but that she somehow wronged her husband with becoming pregnant from this other man's child, that she is used goods. And she sees herself as used.
She takes
She takes it personally as though she did something wrong. And Lord.
Which, again, so these two side characters and why they also show another complete amazing perspective to look at, were Hiyori's tragedy and Sasuke. They're both tragic in the sense they lost their husbands and then raped and has a kid. So much awful substance there. But looking at their important side characters besides Misaki, because then you see how Misaki and her husband, who's alive, handle life. And we're getting that whole story. Now we're getting the stories of wives who lost their husbands at war. And the important part was Sasuke, of how after her husband's death, she, of course, grieves, but has a positive way to go forward, or kind of the great message you put of she knows her husband died what he loved for. And it's almost that kind of love Sasuke felt, and why she's such an admirable character, is she loves her husband so much that she would rather have him be, she would rather have him, sorry guys, all. So she loves her husband so much that despite her own happiness, of course she would want her husband to live the rest of his life with her. But that almost is selfish, because she knows that his true happiness was elsewhere. So she loved her husband more than she loved the selfishness of keeping him alive for her, which is just, wow, that is love. And then on Hiyori's point of view, where you look at what happened to her and just go, how the hell do you even find any light? And she ends up committing suicide, and you're left with just complete tragedy. And you look at how Sasuke was able to turn this positively, then Hiyori, how you just saw the worst case scenario. And
ultimately, there's also the important critique of course, Hiyori's friends, Misaki, and can you say her name again?
Sasuke.
Sasuke. did their best for her and were incredibly supportive and doing everything they could. But the rest of the village definitely let her down and shunned the child because, like,
I forgot about that. Great point.
Treated the child as a outcast, as a treated the child like the enemy, and also treated Hiyori like she was damaged goods and not as a victim, but as a perpetrator somehow.
And she was in the end a victim of both her attacker, of her rapist, and a victim of her own society.
Yeah. She did not kill herself solely because of, like, her attacker. It was how her society actually taught her to behave in some of these ways and how she treated herself. And then that being confirmed by the rest of their village. And so it is a condemnation of, like, shows some of the things of, you know, traditions can get things wrong. Obviously, this is one of those things of their tradition is wrong. That means, like, you don't treat people that way, and they shouldn't. So you have that. But then you also have, like, how much they care for their children. And there's a bunch of the other standard traditional stuff, the things on discipline, how they treat others. Like, there's plenty of good that you kind of passed on, like the fact that Momaro is as good as he is and how strong and self-capable and self-sacrificing the men of the village are. And ultimately, those are some great things that, you know, we want to just talk about kind of both sides of that.
Giving, I see what you mean, the balance of, there's a reason this society is so powerful and strong and was able, they're the front line to everything because it works for them to create this, these juggernauts of fighters who, can I transition for us into, like, finish with the characters for the most part and just go, we mentioned all of this about this damn masterpiece and haven't even touched on how badass the fight scenes are. Just sure, besides the emotions, the themes, the impact it has, how thought-provoking this is, it also just has these warriors, and you have the incredible magic with the ice dragon and the and the duels. Fact that, and shit, this is just...
You understand, before this book, watching Avatar The Last Airbender when I was younger, and then also again, like, rewatching, going like, man, this world is so cool. The magic system's awesome. I want to see what this would be like at its pinnacle. Like, push it to the limit. Ultimately, the magic system is hindered a little bit by the target audience that it's going for. Ultimately, Avatar can't go too far.
Avatar
Aang
can't kill people, although he does. He definitely does.
He doesn't kill people. You start to get a little bit more of that with the bloodbending, and then Zaheer with after Korra, that whole thing. You get a little bit more. But ML Wang does elemental bending better than Avatar The Last Airbender. Describes in a way, like, take it to its extreme, take it to its maximum, its peak. Loved it. Like, I don't need to watch Avatar anymore. I don't care what Avatar next puts out. Like, I'm not anticipating. Like, I got what I needed. I got my Avatar world building magic fight. I'm good. I'm done.
Read that whenever you want. It's always there.
I got the sequel. I got the fight scenes from Avatar that I wanted in here.
And it helps when you have the really cool element of all the three best fighters. So Takaru, his brother, and then the trainer, Yukino, I believe. But how they all had their different fighting styles as well was so cool.
Oh, or how they work together.
Precision versus agility versus just raw strength. And how they work together to use the brothers use that precision, and just, no one can miss him. He's just spot on and deadly with his brother's absolute...
Yeah, just ferocious power.
And how he died, that epic scene. He dies and just... Oh, you see bodies slain around him, and then so the world building in that regard, for the magic, and also a really unique world where the technology is kind of happening around you, but you're in this isolated area where they're... I was so thrown off in the best possible way when the first couple chapters, I think it was the first chapter of this book, mentions how there's a cell phone tower was coming in.
Oh, yeah.
Or no. A radio tower? Was it?
I think someone mentioned a game system. The foreigner, Quang.
I forget his name. He was so insignificant in the story compared to everybody else.
I liked what he did for the story, but like
not worthy of this discussion right now.
This so, is fine. But no, so when well. He brought like, oh yeah, the Game Boy thing. It's like, what?
I thought I was reading like I was. My mind was in 1500s, and now I'm going 2019 something. Like where is this technology? And that Matt immediately hooked onto what is going on in this world and why it still works with how badass the magic system is, because the magic system outdoes all this technology that they could possibly have to attack them.
Well, that was kind of a really fun thing of seeing the flashbacks with Misaki and the city and just kind of where, to a certain degree, technology was outpacing the magic system, of a lot of people kind of thinking that, hey, look, this magic, like the elemental bending is kind of a thing of the past. Like, technology now is outstripping it. You know, we have these swords that are more powerful. Like, ultimately, on a general level, technology equalized things, and the magic was not as important.
Oh, except for our society here.
But our little village is just so elite that they prove that wrong.
Right.
Take it to its peak.
Good clarification.
Nothing stands in there. Like, even the best technology at the time can't stand to them.
They're still above technology, whereas in the outside world, tech was catching up.
Basically, it's kind of like that underdog story. You start at a certain level, you're going like, oh man, there's this backwater village, and you go like, how sad, how pitiful it is that they're so far behind, that like everything that they're doing that it's for naught, that all of their effort is pointless.
Yeah.
And then they prove them wrong.
Yeah.
Look at them.
you also got to respect Ewa Wang for her naming of things, where everyone knows, not Avatar The Last Airbender, but Avatar the film, where it's called Unobtainium. We've got in this book the Whispering Blade.
Do you know that it was actually the title of a book I was writing?
What? I was
drafting it, yeah.
Did I accidentally compliment you?
I know. Completely different story and idea, but...
But I just really don't like that I accidentally compliment.
I know. Like, it's still like a Google... It's a Google Doc.
Oh, that's awesome.
In my drive, like,
that's awesome.
The Whispering Blade.
Nice. Oh man! So the magic in here is incredible. It creates for amazing fights. And just to finish up with the plot of this book, okay, we touched on it, but the overarching thing of this book, of what made it probably such a fun read for you, is climax was in the middle. Whoa! And I want to shout out Matt's fantasy book reviews. So he reviewed this and gave it a 4 out of 5 stars. Specifically, one of the things he didn't like was that he really liked book structures that, okay, you have big something that seems like a climax in the middle, then you expect one at the end as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of books have that structure, and he does love subversion of expectations, but he was saying how he really did want another big thing at the end to kind of set up. Which,
to me, I got it.
To me, I did as well. With which scene for you was it?
I mean, it's the aftermath of the duel. Like, the duel, to me, like, that's one of the coolest action scenes. Like, it's thematically of how Misaki, like, discovered her abilities and how her brothers were able to actually lift that heavy sword and realize the strength that her ability has and grow. So you get that action, cool stuff there. One of the best fight scenes I've read. I love that.
Incredible.
But then the emotional payoff of all of that was at the same level as Mamoru and his death. Like, that's the thing. I got great action and an emotional climax and ending.
Totally agree.
So I disagree with Matt's fantasy reviews on that. So I think I got an also awesome epic ending.
Totally agree. And maybe this is the expectations perspective of when we're looking at that ending, we love it so much. It very much microed and narrowed in on the family drama. Whereas, hey, if it's fighting this other empire, I'm not saying this for Matt. This is now off topic of that. It's someone who would read this book and go, oh, it's that kind of story where takes over the empire or fights back against the oppressor. Mm-hmm. Where the story ends with society, okay, besides our village area, the society around them, the oppressive government, doesn't change. They have zero effect. It exists. Nothing you can do, nothing they're doing about it. They're worrying about their family. They're concerned about their family and rebuilding their village, their town, their area, the place they call home. And this oppressive government, it's still the same. Nothing's happening. Nothing will be changed. There's no expectation for it to. But the satisfying part about the ending is, hey, even though that is obdurate, we still have our family. And that satisfying moment of, hey, if our family is more, if the family we're following is more connected and passes this on to the following generations, maybe one day in the future, you'll have a good enough village here to impact change on the world as a whole.
To all of that, I think what makes this book so satisfying and ultimately why it works so well as a standalone, I don't need a second book, is it has that larger scale climax in the middle, and then it clearly shifts of this is now a more personal story, and we get the personal climax, and like, that's what it's about. It's not about the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Like all the rest of the society and the war and all that.
Nope.
Not important. Not important for the story. And where, even though it the last chapter kind of ends off in teasing like there could be a second book, ultimately I just don't think it fits with how the book sets up the entire second half of it's a personal story on family and the drama between them. Not will the, you know, whatever other empire conquer. So that's why I think it works perfectly well as a standalone, and it should be a standalone.
And that one gripe it we would were almost referring...
work, it would work wrong if there was a sequel talking about the
exactly right.
Like then you're going from big war epic to family drama back to big war epic. No. I don't know. I wouldn't
want that. And that gripe we mentioned at the beginning about the last chapter is a bit long and goes into setting up a future novel.
Mm-hmm.
I did think there were some necessary scenes with Robin there for her to look back. And those were, and we didn't even mention Robin throughout this whole thing. But we did as far as saying she chose Takara over Robin, but other than that. So that ending, the gripe we had was that kind of set up something else and was anticipating a subsequent novel. I really don't care that I would have. Again, this is too amazing of a novel to. I just wanted to mention. Yeah, we did have a complaint.
Yeah,
that is our masterpiece ruined.
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 It's absolutely
ruined the day. Man, we could roll our R's. That's gonna be taken out of context.
You gotta roll your R's.
They're just gonna cut from me saying, "Are you sure I didn't bite your lips?" And then it's gonna cut to you going. This was an absolute masterpiece. Rich, do you want to finish with anything else at all for The Sword of Kagan?
Go read this book.
After they listen to the...
If you have... Like, hey, I know there's some monsters that don't care about spoilers.
Yeah.
But go read the book again if you haven't all... If you've read it again, read it more. And give ML Wang all your love. Because...
And money.
She deserves it. And money. Throw her your money.
Bye, everyone.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant.
Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at corient.com. That's corient.com. Corient.com.